This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the audio mind space where you, me and top experts come together and inside 28 minutes wrangle a big issue. It's a year since Russia invaded Ukraine. 12 months on, much of the fighting and dying on the Russian side is being done not by conventional soldiers, but by men employed by a private army, the Wagner Group. So today, what is the Wagner Group? And will Vladimir Putin come to regret using it to fight his war? The Russian invasion of Ukraine is a year old, and the brutal war has spawned two innovations: the mass use of small munition-carrying drones and the mass deployment in a conventional conflict of a private army, the Wagner Group. So what is the Wagner Group? And what do we know about its leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin? And could Wagner be as much of a threat as an asset to Vladimir Putin? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. As we often do on the briefing room, let's start with some history. How and why was the Wagner Group created? Andres Ratz is Senior Research Fellow of the German Council on Foreign Relations in Berlin. Andres Ratz, when did Russia start using private military companies?
The first time Russia created something resembling to a private military company was in 2013. That formation, called Slavonic Corps, was put in action in Syria, but due to the lack of experience, due to the lack of elaborated operational standards, it blatantly failed. It failed because the cooperation mechanisms with the Syrian army were not yet established. There was not proper intelligence provided. There was no proper weaponry provided. So after one skirmish with Syrian resistance fighters, the Russian private military company Slavonic Corps was defeated and the survivors were actually taken back to Russia. And Russia thereafter learned a lot from this mistake. And thereafter, a year later, around 2014, they established the so-called Wagner Group.
We imagine that Wagner and private armies is something of a uniquely Russian phenomenon. But is that really true?
Before setting up the Wagner Group, Russia actively studied how the West has used private military companies in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in other places. For example, Wagner learned a lot from how the US relied on the private military company Blackwater during the operation in Iraq. And the Russians also studied the tasks and operations of several other private military companies as well. They set up first the Slavonic Corps and thereafter the Wagner Group, based on the lessons they learned from Western private military companies. However, Wagner has a number of very particular characteristics which is not present in other Western private military companies. The most important one is that Wagner is extremely closely integrated with Russia's military, particularly with the military intelligence. It looks like that Wagner is more a proxy force of Russia's military intelligence than a real private company. To give you one example, Wagner is using a joint facility with Russia's military intelligence in Molkino in southern Russia. I couldn't name a single other private military company which shares any facility with a given country's military intelligence. Second, Wagner is actively relying on supplies, logistics, intelligence, operational planning on Russia's regular military. So Wagner is not self-reliant. Wagner is not independent. Wagner functions basically as an arm of Russia's regular military. Third, while conventional private military companies are indeed able to conduct high-intensity operations, this is not their main profile. However, Wagner's main profile is high-intensity operations. And fourth, Western private security company works for a wide range of clients. Wagner does not have a single such client that would be independent from the Russian state.
When we go back to Wagner's origins, was it partially based on the Russians looking at private military contractors being used by other countries and thinking, we'll do that, and then it significantly developed a different approach?
Indeed. While in the West, the use of private military companies has been dominantly motivated by the intention to spare some money, for Russia, the most important motivation was ambiguity, to project state power in a covert way.
Is Wagner the only private military company currently engaged by Russia? Has it now got a monopoly, if you like, on the private military company industry?
Definitely not, but Wagner is definitely the biggest one. However, there is an important particularity here. According to Russian law, private military companies are illegal. So Wagner is not registered in Russia as a private military company. Wagner didn't even exist until very recently as a single entity. Instead, Wagner is a composition of dozens, or if not hundreds, of shell companies. So Wagner is not a single entity. Wagner is more an intellectual construct and the brand or an umbrella under which there are several smaller organizations.
We've heard in the news that Wagner has also been operating in other continents, including Africa. And the question that you immediately ask yourself is, how can one company be active in so many places? Is the answer to that the one you've just suggested, which is that actually it's incredibly diverse?
Yes, it's very diverse and it's also fairly large. Before the February 2022 escalation in Ukraine, Wagner had around 6,000 to 10,000 operatives. And several operations it conducted in Africa were, in terms of size, relatively small, deploying a few dozens of people, deploying a few hundred people. So Wagner was able to maintain and run more than a dozen operations in Africa and in other countries at the same time. Wagner also made an action in South America, in Venezuela. It was actually the Wagner group which saved President of Venezuela, Maduro, from being removed by the democratic opposition. What was the Russian interest behind that? Russian state oil company Rosneft had more than $12 billion investment in Venezuela, and Moscow was afraid that should the democratic opposition win, this investment would have been endangered.
What would a typical Wagner operation in Africa look like, and who would actually be paying for it?
Wagner is able to operate only in such places where the state power is weak. Wagner is offering a wide range of services, ranging from just training local soldiers to guarding facilities, providing VIP protection, or in some cases, doing the actual fighting. Unstable regions tend to be short of cash. So in many cases, Wagner operatives get paid in kind, in natural resources. For example, in Syria, Wagner's work in liberating oil fields was paid in concessions on that given oil field. There were cases when Wagner was offered a 25% share in each and every oil well they liberated. In some African countries, the concessions are in mining concessions or diamond trade-related concessions.
In terms of international law, is what Wagner does in these countries, is it legal?
The legality of the operations of private military companies often tends to be a somewhat shaky or somewhat ambiguous ground. It's not always easy to define what exactly is legal, but there are many cases when the operations of Wagner have been documented being outright illegal and violating international humanitarian law. There have been cases when Wagner operatives committed crimes against humanity, committed actual war crimes. So if I would need to give a binary answer, whether it's legal or not, my answer would be that in most cases, it's more illegal than not.
Andras Ratz with the origins and scope of the Wagner Group. We'll spend the rest of the programme now looking at the group's role in the war in Ukraine and the implications for the Russian leadership of having such a force recruited by and operating under the command of a private individual, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Joining me now are Marina Myron, postdoctoral researcher at the Department of War Studies at King's College London, Samantha de Benden, associate fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, and Joanna de Deus Pereira, senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute Europe, based in Brussels. Samantha de Benden, let's talk a bit more about Wagner's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Who is he?
Well, he's an absolutely fascinating character, and I think one day Hollywood will pay millions to do a Netflix series about his life. It really is out of a movie. He was born into a modest family in St. Petersburg, and St. Petersburg is important because that is also Vladimir Putin's town. He was a petty criminal. He's actually been in prison for armed robbery. And when he came out of prison, which was just about the same time the Soviet Union was collapsing and private property and private enterprise was allowed, he became a hot dog seller. And he really began to make a fortune that way. Now, the way St. Petersburg was in the early 90s, you could not make a fortune unless you were involved with organized crime. And also, you had to have some kind of link with the Leningrad, then St. Petersburg government, of which Vladimir Putin was part. And it looks as though his links with Putin really cemented in the early 2000s, but he's known him for a while, since the whole murky world of St. Petersburg crime and government mixed up together. And Prigozhin really made his really big fortune as a caterer to the armed forces and to Russian schools. These are, of course, state contracts. So, you know, the whole concept of a private businessman who made most of his money on government contracts, again, shows the interlinking between government, business and crime in Russia, which is why he epitomizes, in a way, everything that is wrong with the Russian system and the way capitalism developed in Russia.
Samantha, I first came across him when there were those revelations about these troll factories in Russia, which were pushing out fake news and propaganda around about the time of the American presidential election in 2016. What was Prigozhin's role in all that?
Well, he claims that he founded them. Again, these are Prigozhin's claims. I don't know whether he actually founded them or not, but the troll factories are seen as an inherent part of Russia's hybrid warfare arsenal, you know, that information warfare is integrated into the whole Russian military doctrine, in fact. What we see here is that the ultimate multitasker, chef, military leader, now claims he's founder of troll factories, all of these are, of course, duties that are also ones that the Russian government wants to pursue.
Now, at some point or other, he bought into Wagner, which had already been set up. What do we describe him now as? Is he CEO of Wagner? Is he commanding officer of Wagner?
He is seen as being the leader of Wagner, and he is definitely seen as being the commander of Wagner. He's out there on the terrain, commanding his troops. And this is a stark contrast to any of the official Russian military. You don't see Sergei Shoigu, the Russian Minister of Defense. You don't even see Valery Gerasimov, the Chief of General Staff. You definitely don't see Putin with the troops on the ground in the theater of war the way Prigozhin is.
Marina Myron, can we establish when Wagner started operating in Ukraine? I mean, were they there back in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea?
Well, after the annexation of Crimea, Allegedly, the Wagner Group was deployed to train the opposition in eastern Ukraine. So those were the little green men, which didn't have any insignia on their uniform. So nobody kind of knew to whom they belong. And it was also that time when Putin would deny any sort of connection, even existence or knowing about the existence of the Wagner Group. And we have seen a kind of similar behavior in Syria when the Wagner Group was used in Syria to do all the dirty work for the Russian armed forces there. And so it is plausible to believe that that's when Wagner's operations started in Ukraine.
Right. So that's when it started. Were they subsequently involved in the lower level fighting that's been going on in eastern Ukraine ever since? Do we know?
I would assume that they were indeed, because they also needed to train the units, the resistance units. And so according to some of the reports that I have read, also the Russian side is denying any kind of involvement. So we have to take everything with a grain of salt from what we know. But it would be plausible to say that indeed they were involved in combat operations.
Joanna Dadesh-Pereira, let's go back a year to the beginning of the current conflict in Ukraine. Were Wagner involved from the start, as far as we know?
There were indications that several battalion groups were moved from Africa, from Mali and Central African Republic, before the invasion of Ukraine. Actually, there are several indications and proofs that they were moving 6 months ahead of the invasion.
Is it your impression, Joanna, that because we know that not many people were informed about the imminent invasion of Ukraine, that one of the people who might have known that it was going to happen is therefore Prigozhin?
Yes.
Samantha, where has Wagner recruited the soldiers that it operates from, the ones who are on the ground? I presume that some of the initial ones were people who'd been fighting in Africa and so on, were trained soldiers, but subsequently...
Yes, so initially he was using his trained soldiers, but there were many deaths, so he had to get more soldiers. So he went to Russian prisons. And this was a very interesting episode because he turned up in late August, early September, filmed recruiting soldiers in prisons and offering them amnesty if they served the 6 months in Ukraine. Now, under Russian law, only one person can offer amnesty, and that is the president. Parliament can sometimes also offer amnesty to prisoners, but there's a whole lengthy legal process. This was just announced, and Prigozhin managed to recruit. Some of the figures that British intelligence has come up with are around 50,000 prisoners. And the first batch of prisoners who survived, because the figures also point to about an 80% death rate within those Wagner troops. The first batch of prisoners was actually pardoned in January. Again, on what legal basis? At some points, journalists were asking the prosecutor general, you know, what is the legal basis for these pardons? And the prosecutor general couldn't answer. In the end, Dmitry Peskov and the Kremlin spokesman, and later Vladimir Putin himself, said these pardons are perfectly legal, but there are just some secret decrees. So again, we have this opacity of how he was recruiting. Now he is no longer allowed to recruit in prison.
Surely you don't get good soldiers out of prisons. Marina?
Well, it depends on what you need them for, right? So Defense Minister Shoigu gave Prigozhin a carte blanche to recruit from prisons. Because as we have seen during the so-called special military operation, the Russians have seen they have manpower shortage. It wasn't a bad idea. It was something that is politically acceptable to the general population because you don't care, you know, if prisoners die on the battlefield or if they die in the prison. For the people, it's important that their sons do not die because Russians are still suffering from this Soviet Afghanistan syndrome. So it was quite an interesting and smart move, both politically and kind of in operational and tactical terms.
Joanna, do you agree that in effect, the Wagner forces have proved to be more effective or created more effectiveness for the Russian forces than the Russian forces had managed on their own?
Well, yes, I think they were more effective than the Russian army, but this will never be recognized by the official channels.
Well, that's very interesting, because I believe that there was some boasting by Prigozhin after the capture of a town, the town of Soledad. Firstly, the suggestion is that it actually was quite militarily significant, that capture.
Yes, I think this is actually one of the points of contrast between what Prigozhin says and what the Ministry of Defense and the Kremlin officially are trying to pass to the media and to the Russians themselves. And this is a point of clash as well between Shoigu and Prigozhin, because when Prigozhin came and his appearance in the media escalated over the last weeks regarding his victories, the role of Wagner in the conflict, the role of his men gaining terrain, this was not recognized. This was not recognized by the Kremlin. And this is not recognized by the Kremlin because Prigozhin officially doesn't have any formal standing. He is not recognized as a politician. He is not recognized as an official voice of the Kremlin. He was, until September last year, a tool for the Kremlin and for Russia. But now this tool has become visible, and visibility in the eyes of the Kremlin is not a very positive thing, especially when you know it in control of it.
I wanted to add something to what Joanna said about the performance of the Wagner Group on the battlefield. And I think we should be very cautious when we're trying to compare the performance of a group which has a completely different, much more flexible structure to that of the Russian military, which is much more rigid and has many echelons of military hierarchy in terms of when it comes to decision making. And so upon the first glance, and this is what Wagner and specifically Prigozhin is benefiting from, is the fact that he can deliver results because they have some sort of unity of effort. But in terms of command and the command structure, when it comes to Wagner, it is completely different. So we have to be very cautious by what metrics we're trying to compare the performance of the Wagner Group versus the armed forces on the battlefield, because there are some different underlying issues from which the military is suffering. And I think that Prigozhin has been kind of trying to lead by example and to introduce more flexibility and to introduce more kind of decentralized decision making at the lower levels.
Samantha Tabenden, when Prigozhin was claiming this sort of great victory and it's not being recognized by other people in the Kremlin, how do the ordinary Russian people get to know about it?
Well, the Russian government has actually told all official Russian news outlets to stop mentioning Yevgeny Prigozhin and the Wagner Group. But most Russians are getting a lot of their information from informal information channels such as Telegram.
For those that don't know, Telegram, isn't it, is a messaging system a little bit like WhatsApp.
Yes, Telegram has become a very important tool, both for the far-right, radical, pro-war faction, and also for anybody who wants to express a different opinion and all the anti-war factions. So Prigozhin's, really one of his big ways of communicating is through Telegram, and it is heard. But the fact that the Russian government has now basically put a moratorium on talking about him in official channels shows that they are trying, well, Putin and the MOD are trying to distance themselves from him more and more. There was a very interesting letter that was made public a few weeks ago. It was a response by Valery Gerasimov, the chief of staff, to a group of people who had asked for information on their loved ones who had been in the Wagner Group and who had disappeared. And this letter basically said the Wagner Group is not part of the Russian armed forces and we cannot give any information on the whereabouts of anybody who was enlisted in Wagner. So, yeah, the Russian people are relying mainly on Telegram for information on Prigozhin and Wagner.
Joanna, given those conflicts, do you think that Prigozhin sees himself as a rival to Putin or as a rival to the armed forces? In other words, I suppose what I'm asking you is, what are his ambitions?
I think he has political ambitions, and he has been trying to build up his political persona over the last months, at least since September. On Tuesday, he was claiming that he was in the battlefront and he was not receiving ammunition. And actually, he appealed in a very emotional speech that his men were dying. So first he put outside a voice message, then he put on Twitter and on Telegram two photographs of their men lying on the floor dead, and also a small short video of another group of men, of Wagner men, aligned in a kind of morgue, and saying, please do not mess with us and help us. And what happened today, this morning, he published on Telegram that he is going to receive ammunition and that he's very happy for the support he received from the Russians and all the people that pressured the government.
How do you think Putin now regards Prigozhin?
Now, I think at the beginning, he saw him as a tool. Now he sees him as a competitor. I think now we have an emotional problem again. And the battle of emotions is a battle that is being played amongst Russian citizens. So you have on one hand the leader of your country that doesn't recognize Wagner officially, doesn't want to have any official connection with Prigozhin. And on the other hand, you have the doer. And because to the eyes of the Russians, the doer is now Prigozhin. And this makes him a competitor rather than an ally.
Can I ask both Marina and Samantha, do you broadly agree with that analysis that Prigozhin has made powerful enemies inside at the top in Russia, and therefore his position is both powerful and precarious? Samantha?
I agree completely with the analysis, and all the public overtures he's been making the last few days are of a man of the people. He's the man who's on the ground, who sees what's happening, who's relating the reality of the soldiers. This will not go on deaf ears in Russia. This is going to maybe seem a little bit heretical. He actually reminds me a bit of Donald Trump, the sort of anti-elitist millionaire, except Prigozhin is actually on the ground and saying all these things that are going to have resonance. He is making powerful enemies. There have been videos circulating of Wagner troops practicing firing, doing firing practice, with the photographs of General Lapin and Valery and Gerasimov as targets. Very interesting.
Marina?
In terms of kind of his political ambitions, he might be aiming to replace Sergei Shoigu as a defense minister who's been in that post for over a decade now, together with General Gerasimov. He would be a threat if he was to assume any kind of official political position in the MOD, because if you look at the background of those in the kind of higher echelons of Russia's military establishment, they are former KGB, FSB, GU. So not a lot of them are career military officers. And there is a good reason for that, because Putin doesn't want any sort of possibility of a military coup. And that has been a concern since the Soviet times, when you had KGB kind of, you know, looking at what the army is doing, like one or two agents would be assigned to each battalion to ensure that, you know, they don't turn against the government.
Samantha, a brief last question to you, and it sounds a bit macabre, but if this was a thriller, there's absolutely no way that Prigozhin wouldn't end up exiting a top floor window in a high building. Do you think he will actually survive?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it will be very interesting if he does survive. I mean, the advantage is right now he's in Bakhmut, where there are no windows left. So I think if I were him, I'd actually stay there, because it's probably safer. But there is definitely a price on his head. I think he's making a lot of enemies. And if this were a thriller, I think the focus would be on the hitman who's trying to catch him.
Samantha Dependen there with Marina Myron and Joanna Dedeish Pereira. My thanks to them and to my other guest, Andras Ratz. So what do we take from all that? Well, I think principally that this is a rather perilous way to fight a war. We'll be back next week.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Daniel Gordon. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by James Beard. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, where you'll find a whole back catalogue to listen to, including the one about what role building regulations and politicking played in the deadly earthquake in Turkey and Syria, the one on how we get over 50s back to work, or whether we should, and the one on how worried we should be about avian flu.
Are you fed up
with the news?
In the last few minutes, I've been talking to Michael Gove.
Its snake-like mouth quivered and slapped like wet leather.
The skewer.
The skewer.
The skewer.
The news chopped and channeled.
President Biden has used his annual State of the Union address to tout his administration's record.
Are you trying to stall us, or are you just senile?
A little from column A, a little from column B.
It's everything you need to know,
like you've never heard it before.
Prime Minister, you don't drink, you've never smoked, never taken drugs.
No.
You're a bit of a nerd.
Thanks for reminding me.
So many people are suffering.
Yes, I think that's what the country deserves.
The biggest story.
Next. With a twist.
The energy giant BP has indeed announced that their underlying profits more than doubled.
Singing in the oil.
Some men just want to watch the world burn.
In terror attack warning, this is the sound.
By John Holmes.
And a crack team
of sound wizards.
You're a wizard.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.